Welcome to Inside Seaweed, the podcast looking deep into the seaweed industry through the stories of pioneers, entrepreneurs, and innovators. I'm Fed the Gobby, and today's episode is one of two very special interviews I recorded in Portland, Maine, last September during Seagriculture Conference US. My guest for day one of the conference was Matthew Perkins, CEO of Macro Oceans. Matthew spent about a decade working in terrestrial agriculture, bringing new genetic and digital technologies to market. His experience on land brings a unique angle to his approach on seaweed, which I think you will find really valuable. So without further delay, here's my conversation with Matthew Perkins. Good morning, Matthew. Welcome to Inside Seaweed.
Good morning. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure. We've got a massive room today. I feel like we're still waiting for somebody to arrive. Should we move every 10 minutes and try to see which table works best?
Different places, and maybe we'll just pretend we're, you know, at one of these massive conferences making a big presentation.
You've studied and worked in Boston, which is not far from here. Is that right?
That's right. I was at grad school in Boston. I worked for a startup there as well. So have spent some time in the Northeast.
So you've been to Portland before?
Yeah. I mean, actually, we're really lucky because Portland is a foodie hub in the Northeast. So there's really great food, beer, cocktails, coffee, seafood, whatever you want, really.
Okay. I'll put it in the list for this evening.
Sure.
I wanted to start with your story in particular by looking at into the decade that preceded you becoming the founder and CEO of Macro Oceans. Take us back to, say, 2009, if that feels right, a good point to start. You know, you've just gained your MBA from Harvard Business School. What was your first move and what were the motivations driving you at the time?
Well, you're dating me now, so this is dangerous territory. I guess to really understand what I did after business school, you have to go back a little bit further. So, you know, growing up, I realized pretty early on that I wanted to try and spend my years that we have here on this planet trying to do something impactful and help, you know, meaningful to me. And for me, that always meant trying to solve a lot of big problems. And one of the biggest problems that I always recognized as an undergrad student was global development and poverty, in particular, extreme poverty in places like Africa. After university, I was a history and politics major, and I became a UK diplomat. I worked for the UK's Department for International Development. And I spent 6 years there, which was really wonderful and fascinating. And I wanted to do something still related to development after business school. And really, in a lot of poor countries, there's sort of two big drivers of development, economic development. Those are, you know, education, improving the underlying skills of the population, and agricultural development. And I looked a bit at education, and I thought, this is a bit complicated, and I ended up in agriculture because that really was something that was fascinating to me. So, you know, I had some student debts to pay, and didn't know anything about agriculture. So I ended up working at Syngenta, which is a big seed and chemical company, and in their corporate strategy team. And it was really wonderful because I got a cockpit view of the industry. And I got paid to really learn everything from the value chain, from seed to, you know, finished products that consumers use. And so that kind of started me off on this trajectory in the agricultural world.
Fantastic. And how did YieldPop come about?
You know, I spent a couple of years in Syngenta's corporate strategy team. And then I was moved into the vegetables business. So I was global product manager for Cucurbits, which is cucumbers, watermelons, melons, and squash. And so I learned more than I probably ever wanted to know about those crops. And that's kind of where I really realized that, you know, what I really love doing is bringing great technology out of the lab and into the real world to solve problems. And it was also kind of where I realized that, you know, I'm just not a good big company corporate guy. So I really had this itch to start a business. And it was very early in the days of digital agriculture. You know, this is back in 2012. And it really was the beginning where people were starting to think about data on the farm. How do you get data off your combine? How do you understand what's going on with different seeds that you're using? And so what we did is we thought, well, farmers, there's a lot of opacity in that market. If it's very hard for farmers to understand what's the difference between seed genetics that they're buying. And so what we did is we went out across the Midwest and we essentially knocked on all the doors of university professors, extension offices, anywhere that had run a field trial, mostly for corn and soybeans in the US. And we essentially put it all in a giant database. So we had 200,000 public field trials. We normalized all the data. We ran a bunch of statistics over the top of it. And we sold subscriptions to farmers to let them really understand what is this seed going to do in my soil type, my geography with the operation that I have. So that was the business.
What sort of challenges do you face during that period? Were the farmers receptive to that sort of idea and approach?
Yeah, farmers, I would say, sort of roughly divide into three groups. So there's one third of farmers who are extremely brand loyal. So they buy DeKalb seed, their father bought DeKalb seed, their grandfather bought DeKalb seed. They're never going to change. They're just going to buy the same stuff. Then there's a group of farmers who are very price conscious. They're just looking for the best deals. And then there's kind of a group of farmers who are really trying to understand performance. They're very data driven. And those were our customers. They were the ones who really were looking for this information. It was very hard to come by and difficult to trust, honestly, because the only people putting out information were the seed companies. And so would you really trust them for telling you how their seed performs in different conditions? You want to actually see real data from farms that are like yours. And that's really what we were doing.
Any other challenge in sort of going through this journey?
Yeah, I mean, it's extremely hard to sell products to farmers. And so they're generally speaking a skeptical type. If you're a corn farmer, you have 40 seasons in your lifetime, right? You have 40 chances to grow a crop. You bet the farm literally every time you put the seed in the ground. So you don't want to make any mistakes. And so you're very skeptical of people coming to you with new secret things and I'm going to increase your profitability. They'll try it out. They'll see how it goes. They'll incrementally improve. So they're a tough bunch to work with. They don't just jump straight in. They generally are very polite, but skeptical of everybody who turns up.
Was there any sort of specific watershed moment that redefined your approach and influenced the way you operated since?
Yeah, I mean, I think it taught me that startups are essentially, you know, your secret weapon is your ability to move fast. We could take real feedback on what people were doing with our product. And we could, you know, make changes and push them out really quickly. So the quicker we could get into that cycle of trying to figure out what people really wanted, how we were creating the best product for them, and we could get that feedback and make changes, that allowed us to really move the business quickly. And you just are not able to do that in big company environments. It's just set up for different things. And so that's kind of the biggest, I think, the biggest takeaway for me was, you can really make a lot of progress if you just think differently and really focus on what is the real thing you're trying to deliver for the farmer and do have real data to prove that it's working.
You may have already answered this, but was there anything that you found easy or that you found worked really well in your approach?
I think being very clear about what it is you're trying to learn when you're in the early stages of product development, it's easy to put something out there and it's easy to get a false positive as well and potentially a false negative. So, you know, what do you consider success and what do you really want to learn when you're trying to get to that product market fit? It can be very disorientating in the beginning.
That's a very good point. Okay. And then what happened?
Yeah. So we were growing that business. We were kind of capital raising. We had bootstrapped the business ourselves. And, you know, we got introduced to the team at the Climate Corporation. One thing led to another. They were really trying to build farmer-facing software. They didn't really know how to do it. We had a pretty good track record and they decided to buy our business. And we went to help them build software for a few years. That's how I ended up on the West Coast and working for Climate Corporation.
So we've been talking about agriculture, and I realize this podcast is about seaweed, but what we've got here is that you bring a relatively rare, I think, and extremely valuable perspective in that you've experienced both aquaculture and agriculture. Agriculture as meaning land agriculture and farming. What do you see as the main similarities and differences between these two dimensions?
Well, I think that the big difference in seaweed is they're really... the industry is so early they're right at the start. At least I'm now talking about non-Asian production. We always need to recognize that Asia grows 99% of the world's seaweed, and it's a very well-established industry. In North America, it's just extremely early. And a lot of things that are well accepted or well practiced in land-based agriculture just don't exist in seaweed. People haven't thought about it. And so that's, for me, the main difference. The similarities are actually quite striking. I would say farmers are salt of the earth kind of people. They're stewards of the land. They're rooted in their place. They believe in growing food for the world. And all of the seaweed farmers are actually very similar, right? They are very rooted in the ocean. They're there to protect the ocean, to grow a nourishing crop for the planet, for the people that they are making it for. So in that sense, the cultures are quite similar. They're fiercely independent as well. And, you know, these are all small family businesses and entrepreneurs. Every single seaweed farmer out there is one of these, just like a land farmer. So the community is actually very similar in many ways. And then I think the other big thing is the value chains look actually pretty similar.
Tell me more about that, because I think that's a really interesting area to explore.
Yeah, so I think if you look at agriculture, at least production agriculture, in the United States, the big crops are wheat, corn, soybeans, and those crops are commodities. So they are produced in lots of different farms. They are aggregated by traders, and then they are turned into things that downstream customers can buy and want. There are very few farms, agricultural farms, which are vertically integrated. So if you think about seaweed, actually, you know, and this is maybe where our take on the industry is a little bit different than what other people have been doing so far. But it's not too dissimilar. There are a lot of farmers out there. There are a few people who are buying and aggregating seaweed, nascent still, and then turning it into formats that make sense for downstream customers. In this case, in North America, primarily in the food space today. But yeah, that's, for me, the market structure is really actually going to end up looking quite like terrestrial agriculture.
Moving in more into that kind of framework.
Yeah, I think, I mean, my hypothesis is that it's extremely difficult to be successful if you're fully vertically integrated, simply because there are so many different businesses that you need to master. If you want to master being really good at growing seaweed and being really good at processing it and being really good at making consumer products and marketing them to people, that's a lot of businesses all in one. So you're now multiplying the challenges that you're going to face, and your chances of being successful are lower.
You think this element is something that you've brought from your experience in agriculture and that has influenced your approach into getting into the seaweed industry?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, actually, when I first started out, I was obviously from the seed world. I was really excited about kelp seed in particular. I thought that would be, kelp genetics is kind of a new frontier because it's only just being domesticated. So there's so many improvements you can make to the quality of the crop we can give to farmers, or the quality of the seed, I should say. But then I realized there just weren't that many people growing seaweed. So we started on the other end of the problem, which was, how do we build markets for seaweed? So, yeah.
We'll come back to that later. Is there anything that you've learned during your time in land-based agriculture that you think is still applicable in your role now as CEO of MacroOceans?
I think the primary thing for me is to look at what has been done in land-based agriculture for solving problems that we have. So I give you a very simple analogy, for example. In our process, we have been looking at liquid-solid separations. And, you know, some of these are challenging. It's with seaweed. We have high viscosity. We have other processing parameters we're trying to figure out. But we can always go over to the food world or the natural products world or even chemicals and say, okay, well, how do they do this in other places? And how do we translate that into the seaweed world? And so my philosophy for so many things that I approach in MacroOceans is, a lot of these things are solved problems. How do we translate them appropriately into our context? And that's where the innovation is. It's not about, we're not building a fusion reactor. And so I think, you know, that's something that I try to bring every day. You know, what have I seen elsewhere? Who else might know how to do this? And how do we bring that innovation to the seaweed industry?
Does that help with the speed of innovation in terms of, okay, let's not reinvent the wheel. This has happened before. This problem has been resolved before. Does that philosophy and approach help you in getting to a solution quicker, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, there's two components. So one is you have to ask the right question. So, you know, what are you trying to solve and why? And then who has perhaps already thought about this, done it, or showed how it could be done, and how can you bring it? So you can go really fast and you can do certain things, but if you're not asking the right fundamental questions, you won't come up with a good innovation that solves that problem.
Okay, so when did you decide to basically start another company?
Yeah, so I guess back in 2017, 2018, 2019, I was working at Inari. It's a gene editing startup based out of Cambridge, Massachusetts. And I started to, the company had grown quite a lot. I was employee number 30 there, the first business hire, and I'd built a lot of the things that I went there to do. And my wife wanted to move back to the West Coast. She's from San Francisco, born and raised. And so I started looking around for new opportunities. So in 2020, I started exploring ideas, and that's when MacroOceans came about.
What were the considerations in going into this new venture?
Well, I think I, like many people, had gotten quite excited about seaweed as an environmental solution to many of our climate challenges. We can talk about that in more detail. But I think what really got me excited was, if you step back and you think about where the world is going, we're going to go through this major transition in the next, say, 20, 30 years as we move away from petroleum, particularly petroleum and natural gas. The petrochemicals industry is enormous and it's ubiquitous, right? Everything from surfactants to lubricants to, you know, plastics, most famously, are made from petrochemicals. And if we're serious about getting to net zero, we have to essentially phase them out. And fundamentally, I'm not a degrowth person. You know, I think we're going to have to find alternatives, and alternatives means bio. Bio is going to boom, and bio can be defined extremely broadly, right? It's everything from terrestrial crops to microbes fermenting stuff into, you know, new molecules, to fungi, to even algae. And algae, microalgae is, you know, singular cell organisms, and macroalgae being aquatic plants. And, you know, I think we believe that macroalgae is just this pretty interesting untapped resource. But the thing that really got me excited was when I realized compositionally that kelp is actually a sugar crop, right? It's about 60 to 65% carbohydrates. And if you look at the other major sugar crops out there, corn being number one, it's ubiquitous. It's used, also used everywhere, right? It's in obviously food products, it's in feed for animals, it's even turned into ethanol for fuel. And so it stood to reason in my mind that actually we could find out a way to take kelp and turn it into the next, you know, ultra low impact, low carbon feedstock for a whole range of chemicals. And so that's kind of where I started with the idea, and that's how it got going.
Yeah. And you mentioned the sort of geographical location. Was that important in any way or relevant to the start of MacroOceans?
Not really. I think California is obviously has a long history of being a place where you can dream big ideas and find people who want to join you on that journey. And there's, you know, access to capital and other things out there that makes it easier to start this kind of business in California. But obviously, you know, we're based in Sacramento. We're in the middle of the state, miles away from the sea. And California is not growing any seaweed, and it's not going to grow any seaweed probably anytime soon. So I think from that perspective, we base the business there because it's a great place for talent, it's a great place for capital, and it's a great place to innovate. So those were all the reasons that we were there, but not because there's a lot of seaweed.
No, of course, yeah. Was it just you at this time or any other people that were involved in the creation of the business?
Yeah. So right at the beginning, it was mostly me. It was really just me and my slide deck. I'm not a scientist. You know, I went out there trying to understand what the opportunity was, put my hands around all of the different components of this business, and really trying to figure out what were the things we needed to solve. And, you know, very quickly, it dawned on me that I needed a sparring partner. So I've been working with James Dillard, who I've known for quite a long time. He joined me as an advisor early on, and we just kind of tried to drill down on all the things that we wanted to figure out to make this business go. So he's really been working with me from the start. And then, you know, very quickly, we need to find a scientist to start working on our biorefinery. And so I was lucky enough to get introduced to Mohammed, who was the founding engineer at MacroOceans. And we built the first prototype. He built the first prototype. And that's what I used to put the plan together and raise capital.
Was all this run out of where? Did you have an office? Did you have a...
Run out of my house,
you know.
Yeah, started in the kitchen, and you know, very soon we needed to find a lab space to run experiments. And so we joined a really nice new incubator lab up in Woodland, which is right near Sacramento, and it's called AgStart. And it's, think of it as a WeWork for scientists. You rent a bench and you get access to centrifuges and, you know, incubators and whatever you need. It's all there, shared equipment. And yeah, so that allowed us to have a pretty cheap startup cost and run the initial experiments that we wanted to do.
I'm thinking the company we know today as MacroOceans, is it the result of several different iterations and pivots, or is it pretty much the result of the original vision?
I still think we're probably still building that thing which we're really going to scale. So I would say we haven't really pivoted. We're still on this original vision. We're iterating in terms of improving the process, in terms of improving the products, in terms of improving the tweaking the recipe and those things, but we're still pretty much moving the plan forwards as we intended. It's not like we started out saying we were going to make a chemical and now we're making food ingredients. We're still very much trying to deliver the original vision.
Can you share anything about the process you're going through in terms of validating your idea and business model?
Yeah, so our business model is pretty simple. We're essentially sitting at the beginning of the value chain, or right after the growers. So we don't farm seaweed, buy seaweed from farmers. We don't make any downstream products. So you'll never see MacroOceans on a face cream in a Sephora. We are very much about sitting in the middle, trying to transform seaweed into things that people want to make downstream products. So that's our model. And so it's a business to business model. And it actually works quite well because we find that downstream customers have, we literally have walked into rooms where people are like, oh, we've been waiting for you, which is always a nice validation point when they, you know, they were, have been looking for a supplier like us and they just haven't existed. So we are essentially one of the very first domestic suppliers, fully domestic supply chain of seaweed derivatives in the nation. And, you know, that's been our positioning and that's seem to work for us pretty well.
What type of products are you working on at the moment?
Yeah, so we've got three products initially in our portfolio, which will expand over time as we increase scale. And I think we can talk about the product strategy if that's interesting. So right now we have a hydrating marine polysaccharide, which is essentially a cosmetic ingredient. This is provides long-term hydration of the skin, which we have clinical data to back up. And yeah, we sell that as an ingredient to clean beauty companies. And we're very soon to launch a partnership or announce a partnership, I should say. We have already launched it internally with Captain Blankenship. They are a clean hair care company based up here, actually, in the Northeast. And they'll be using our product in one of their new product lines coming out in November. So we're very excited about that. And we have a number of other customers in trials right now. These things take time to launch. When you start using a new ingredient, you still have to formulate with it. You have to make sure it's going to work, and then you have to launch the product. So, you know, for a company to launch a new product can take 6 to 9 months for the small guys. And if you're Estee Lauder, it takes 3 years. So, you know, these things take time to incubate, but we're very excited about that opportunity. You know, cosmetics for us is what we call the thin end of the wedge. We're not a cosmetic ingredient company. We see lots of opportunities in cosmetics, but for us, it's a small volume, high value play, which allows us to really get the business going at small volume, small scales, which is super important. The second product we're making is a sodium alginate. So alginate is a polymer that's in the seaweed, in most brown seaweeds. And we're extracting it and turning it into sodium alginate, which we're selling into two markets. The first one is as a food ingredient. And the second market is with regenerative materials companies. So these are people making thin film plastics, fibers, and other things. And with those regenerative materials companies, there's quite a lot of application testing that has to happen to make sure it fits their formulas and formats. And with the food companies, it's a little easier because it's more of a commodity. So that's pretty interesting. And then we have a paper and pulp additive, which is really designed for the packaging industry. This is the cellulosic material that's left over when you're done processing the seaweed. And that we've made some pretty interesting prototypes. We have some customers who are working with it to try and make products. I would say it's a little earlier in the product development pipeline, but we are pretty excited about that because that will close the loop and help us create a zero waste system. Our goal is to use all the seaweed and have nothing left over but a bit of water at the end.
Why is that important?
Well, I think for a number of reasons. First, just from pure economic perspective, if you can valorize all the seaweed, then obviously you help your unit economics for production. That's important. But the other thing is important is that, you know, we don't want to start this business to create more problems than we already have. We started this business to solve some of the problems, to make the economy more sustainable. And if we, you know, are only extracting a tiny fraction of the compounds and selling high value cosmetics and throwing everything else away, we're just creating a lot of waste. And so, you know, our goal is to make a zero waste process. And actually, that's really important to our customers too. That's a story that we talk about how we're working on that. And it's actually very important to them because they wanted to sell that story to their customers.
You mentioned earlier product strategy. How do you think about product strategy? Do you have a specific approach?
Yeah, I think the way we've thought about it is creating a value stack that will support different scales of production. So if you go out there and you only try to make a thin film plastic ingredient, you need very large volumes. It's a relatively low priced material because the thin film plastic guys are trying to compete against polyethylene, polypropylene, which is an extremely cheap commodity. And so if you only did that, you would have to be at really big scale to make it work. And you can't go from zero to really big scale. Investors won't back it. It's just not a sustainable plan. And so we've always thought about a mixture of high value, low volume products alongside sort of medium value products alongside more commodities. And what we've been optimizing for is the positive unit economics at each scale, wherever we go. We only care about the biorefinery unit economics, not the individual product unit economics. And so we're going to be making money at the smaller scale, at the medium scale, and at very large scale. From day one, we'll be positive because that's how we'll build a sustainable business.
Makes a lot of sense. Do you find this is a sort of unusual approach in the industry?
I think it's a little different. You know, the world has changed a lot in the last 18 months from a funding perspective. You know, back in 2022, 21, you know, money was not free, but freely available, I should say. Now it's much less the case. And I think there's been too little focus on really creating products that will be able to, you know, help people build real businesses. I see a lot of people saying, oh, well, I'm going to produce this product and it's be profitable when I get to X thousand tons and seaweed price down, you know, somewhere at the floor. And that is never going to happen because you have no you have no way of crossing that valley of death. And so we've built our model on a very pessimistic case. We buy seaweed at market price today. We are able to make products at different scales as we scale up, and we're able to be unit economic positive at each scale as we go. And so if you can do those things, then you're able to kind of get on that pathway to scaling up. People will believe in your business because it is a real business at the end of the day. It's not just reliant on raising more money or getting another grant.
I'm glancing at my notes and we probably covered a lot of the other things I had in front of me, but I think what could be really interesting to get into is the role and how central is technology in delivering your value proposition. Or maybe another way to put it is, what is important about your technological approach?
Yeah, I think it's really important and it's been overlooked. I think people have thought if they grow more seaweed, then buyers will come. And I think that's not actually true. I think that what we've done is try to think about the problem from first principles. So number one, for us, it never made sense to freeze or to dry the seaweed because at the end of the day, we want to process it wet. So why would we want to pay to freeze it? And why would we want to dry it and then rehydrate it, right? That's a huge amount of extra cost. And so we've developed a stabilization technique to be able to store seaweed at room temperature for up to 12 months. We've proven that out at Benchtop. We're running larger scale trials. It's looking pretty good. And I think, you know, this is potentially quite a good unlock for the industry because it allows farmers to harvest their seaweed, process it, store it, and now they can move it to market when it suits them, when they have buyers. They're, you know, they are able to hold it and not have to immediately freeze it and incur cost or immediately store it. So that's something that we're planning on working with farmers to put that technology out there because we think it could be helpful. We build it for ourselves, but we think there are other use cases where it could be useful, like biostimulants, for example, people who want to, you know, process wet essentially. So that's important. And I think then when you think about the processing approach, we sort of stayed away from food markets and animal agricultural markets and have looked at more other industrial markets. And I think for that, we've really kind of brought a lot of these, like I was saying, translational technologies to get really good recovery yields, because that obviously drives your unit economics, and to make really, you know, high quality, consistent products. This is actually a really technologically difficult thing, because you've got an extremely variable input, your biomass. It changes all the time. It changes from site to site, changes from year to year, changes from species to species. But we have developed technique that allow us to kind of iron out those things and produce consistent outputs on the back end, so that customers are going to get, you know, they want to buy a sodium alginate, they're going to get a sodium alginate that looks the same every year. And so, you know, those are things that take time and effort, and our technologies enables that, if you like. It's not as simple as it sounds.
Is there a lot of R&D involved to get there? How central is that in what you're trying to do?
Yeah, I mean, it's all R&D. And so, you know, we've been around 2.5 years or so, and all of that time has been spent in the lab, you know, in our pilot facility, really working on all of the techniques, the reactions, the processing parameters, the unit operations, running the data, getting all of the analysis done to make sure that the process is actually going to work. So it's absolutely critical to get the technology to perform the way you want it to perform. And it just takes time. You know, I always tell people that science is not linear. You can put it on a slide, you can say it's going to happen next quarter, and then you run the experiment and you're like, oh, that was not at all what we were expecting. And so then it's like, okay, well, what's the problem? How do we unpack that? What should we try and solve? You know, and I mentioned, for example, like a liquid solid separation, it did not work the way we wanted it to. So we had to go out and find new vendors. We had to figure out if there was anything we could do to improve the process parameters so that we could make it easier to separate. So there was a bunch of different things we had to try, and that took an extra, you know, couple of months. And our plan is a little bit behind. So everything is kind of, you need to plan for the difficulty of doing science, because science is not linear, as I was saying.
Yeah, and any surprise that might come up? Any positive surprise?
I think that, yeah, there definitely have been some surprising moments where things which we thought were not going to work really perform well. Like stabilization is one where we tried a lot of different things, and actually the place we ended up is actually quite cost effective, and it works, seems to work well. So, you know, that was surprising, and we kind of stumbled upon that amongst many formulations of our reagents that we thought were other things we thought were going to be more promising.
A bit earlier, you talked about the cosmetic industry being one of your customers, essentially. Why is the cosmetic industry an interesting application for seaweed ingredients?
I think it's an interesting space for a couple of reasons. One, there is a big trend in industry around natural products and clean beauty. For everything from the shampoo you use to your face creams are essentially chemical cocktails. It's just full of, if you ever look at a label, it's all ingredients that you cannot pronounce, right?
It's a long list.
It's a long, long list. And so the big trend in cosmetics is to remove ingredients, number one, and number two, replace them with natural alternatives. And so that's been the big trend. And so we think that's actually really interesting. So our product, for example, allows formulators to remove several ingredients that are chemically derived synthetics and replace them with a natural polysaccharide mix that actually is really effective. And so, you know, that's something that allows them to deliver immediate value for their customers. And I think the other big thing that's interesting in cosmetics is obviously, you know, the margins are really good. So you can definitely allows you to learn and make mistakes in the beginning, because you always make mistakes when you're starting out. And it allows you to immediately kind of shift product in the market at small volumes, because that's where every business begins. And so, you know, high margin, high value products are low volumes is a good place to start. And that's, I think, one of the reasons we started in cosmetics.
Yeah, I was going to ask. So it was a conscious decision for all the reasons that you just mentioned to start and focus on cosmetics.
Absolutely. I mean, we did look a bit at the nutraceutical space.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting.
It's actually pretty complicated and a little bit harder to get into because of some of the regulations on making food ingredients. And actually the customer value proposition is harder too, because there's a relatively low level of trust in the supplement space. And there's more clearer trends and easier things for us to work in with cosmetics. And so that was a decision that we made relatively early on. But I think we are looking still at nutraceuticals. We think that's an interesting market too. We're not exactly sure what the product format will be in that space. We haven't spent a lot of time looking at it.
But you said it's complicated. Is it mostly legislation?
There's just a higher standard of regulations you have to go through to get your what they call the good manufacturing practices, which is the FDA guidelines. So that's not so hard. The challenge is if you are making a novel food ingredient, you have to go through a certification process, or takes about a year and costs a fair amount of money. So you need to be sure you're going to be able to sell your product. So it doesn't allow for as much quick iteration as in cosmetics. And so this allowed us to get in the market quickly. We can improve our product, you know, through a number of clever techniques that will improve efficacy. And we're doing that over time. So, you know, we're launching a product that will kind of only get better as we build. And I think we saw less opportunity to do that in the nutraceutical space because of the regulations.
What have you learned about the cosmetic industry and its supply chain in particular?
I think the thing that is quite interesting and unique about cosmetics is that the brands are essentially all about marketing. They are really about telling the story to the consumer, making sure that the consumer experience is excellent, but they really rely on a number of third parties to help them with developing the, some founders will develop the product themselves, but in general, they work with labs who help them formulate the products, and then they work with contract manufacturers who actually make the products. And so you have to navigate this world of who's really making the decision about what ingredient is going into the product. And we kind of decided to focus on indie brands in the clean beauty space because that allowed us to talk directly to the brands, tell the story, give them some samples. And that works really well in the, you know, when we're starting out, because we can learn about what they're looking for. And we can also get in front of the key decision makers, you know, straight away. But yeah, you have to really understand the industry structure in order to understand who's buying your product. Because at the end of the day, we're actually selling our product to the contract manufacturer who is making the product for the brand.
In terms of impact, we talked about environmental positive impact being a big motivator for you. Are there any big wins in the cosmetic industry that seaweed coming in could replace, for example, petroleum-based ingredients?
I think there's potential to replace things like hyaluronic acid, which is synthetically derived. And yeah, there's definitely areas where they could come in, but I don't think that we should think about this as the place where seaweed is going to make a huge impact, because the volumes are never going to be massive. The places we're going to make impact is when we get to scale on things like building block chemicals and ingredients that can go into thin film plastic replacements and replace polyester materials and these types of things. That's where it's really going to get exciting from an impact perspective, but you have to have a pathway to get there. And so think of cosmetics as the thin end of the wedge. It's the on-ramp to getting to those markets and getting to the scale and impact that you want to have.
And from the cosmetic industry, is there anything, any lesson that could be transferred and applied to other industries touching seaweed, for example, the food industry? Is there anything that you've learned that could be transferred to those markets?
Well, I think the story will be the same, right? When we go out and talk to a brand, we don't really talk about macro oceans at all. We talk about the wilderness, vastness of Alaska. We talk about salt of the earth, people that we work with, the farmers who are growing the kelp, the native communities that are participating. We talk about the natural, you know, abundance and all these kind of beautiful bioactive compounds that are in the kelp and how that, you know, is about bringing the marine greatness to the consumer. So that really is exactly the same story you're going to tell in food. It doesn't make it's no different. And you can see many examples here at the conference of people working on food products. They're all selling the ocean story, right? And so I think that doesn't change. That's anything that's consumer facing, that's the way it's going to be. So I think that's probably the main thing that I would say is translatable from what we've done in cosmetics.
And then it's a huge part of it because, like you said, brands are going to be all about marketing. And I suppose it's probably not that different brands in cosmetic and brands in food.
Yeah, and label simplification is another one. You know, I was talking to a major CPG company that is trying to get synthetic hydrocolloids or natural hydrocolloids, but long word, out of their label. And they're thinking about how seaweed as a raw ingredient could do that for them. And that was kind of an interesting thing I hadn't really thought about. But I think that's the same trend in food. You're seeing a lot of big companies, they're trying to clean up their label and make their products more natural, quote unquote.
I think in food, one of the big questions is going to be whether we want to showcase seaweed being in the food product or whether it's something that brands want to almost sneak in instead.
Yeah, I think the challenge in the food space is that the amount of seaweed that goes into any product is really pretty small. And so if you really want to shift a lot of volume, it's challenging, right? Whereas for us, we process seaweed. And when we start to move more sales with customers, we're going to move a lot of volume of seaweed. And so immediately from day one, we'll be processing a lot of seaweed once these products are in the market. And then there's kind of like demand is going to just build because once these products are successful, they're just going to be asking for more, right? So I think like from that perspective, we like these markets because they are using a lot of seaweed and not just a little bit of seaweed.
Nice. Okay, I'm going to change topic completely and go into what is probably our last question. And it's a bit of a recurring one. In your experience as a seaweed entrepreneur, what do you wish existed? What I mean by that is what innovation do you really need that would make your life easier?
I think that one thing that I think has been missing is a lot of the market infrastructure that we see in agriculture doesn't really exist in seaweed, and I think could be quite useful. So, for example, cooperatives are pretty well established and common structures in agriculture. In, say, the dairy world, you have a group of farmers who are group, you know, get together and they pool their milk and they don't all try and sell their milk. It comes under a brand and then the brand does all the packaging and, you know, processing and distribution and all that stuff. And I think we're missing some of those sort of collaborative, whatever the structure is. I know cooperative can be a bit of a unpopular word amongst fishermen, but I think there's some more collaborative structures around sharing infrastructure. So things like processing equipment, things like harvesting equipment, seed nurseries. Not every farmer needs to have their own hatchery or nursery. That just doesn't make sense, right? And so how can you pool some of those things and where do you cooperate and where do you just do your own thing? I think that's really missing on the growing side. There are people working on that, like GreenWave has been thinking about it and doing some work on that. And yeah, I think that would be really helpful. The other thing that I think would be really helpful is some way to aggregate what supply is out there. So, you know, lots of people have produced kelp. Some of it is sitting in cold stores in different places. You know, if you could aggregate all of that or at least have visibility into it, could you go to a very large customer and actually say, oh, we've actually could fill a large order because collectively we have a lot of kelp, but it individually maybe not that much. And I think some of those kind of clearing mechanisms also exist in agriculture through some of the big buyers, and that doesn't exist yet in seaweed.
So it sounds like there is still a lot more we can learn from land-based agriculture.
I think so. And I think that is kind of, I'm not upset by that because I think that we're very early in the industry. These things will emerge. I think that we just have to keep an open mind about what we want to bring from land-based agriculture. I definitely think we shouldn't transport everything. Like bad would look like, you know, huge monoculture saccharina, massive corporate farms, you know, floating out in the ocean. That would be bad. I think our vision is much more about, you know, how do you get small farmers to thrive? How do you grow location appropriate species and more of like a gardening multi-species approach where unfortunately, but fortunately, the processes will have to figure out how to sort out that, you know, mixture of species. But I think that's really the opportunity here is to build a really fresh new industry and show how regenerative and sustainable it can be, not importing the bad things from land-based agriculture. But at the same time, don't reinvent the wheel. Like look across to the guys who are on the land and they've been there a long time. Like what are the good things that they like that work really well? How do we bring them to the ocean?
Before we bring this to a close and get back to the conference, is there anything else you would like to talk about that we haven't maybe brought up yet?
No, thanks for the opportunity. It's been fun. And I think, you know, I always like to leave people with the thought that the world is changing very fast and there's a lot of things we don't know, but don't wait for the world to change around you, build the change you want to have, you know, build the world you want to live in. That's our responsibility. And hopefully your listeners can take that away and contribute in any way they can. I mean, that's your story, right? And I think hopefully, and I thank you for doing the work, hopefully there'll be more feds coming along and hopefully not making podcasts because you're doing a great job, but you know, trying other things. And that's how we're going to build a better world.
Thank you. No, that's I fully agree. I'm not sure how I feel about too many feds in the world, but where can people find you and Macro Oceans and learn more about what you guys are doing?
Yeah, so you can come and check out our website. It's macro-oceans.com and follow us on LinkedIn. And yeah, happy to chat more and send us an email. And anybody's in California, come look us up. And yeah, we're happy to talk.
Thanks for that. Matthew, it's been so nice meeting you. Thank you for giving up your coffee break and then for the amazing conversation. And thank you all for sticking with us until the end of this interview. That is everything for now. Have a great day and take care.